I'm Zach Fentel. Thank you so much for being here. It's an honor to be on stage with everybody who's spoken today. It's a great lineup. I'm not here to talk about TBD for those who are reading the print agenda. We're here to talk about branding, which shouldn't be a surprise since we're on brand about branding. And I'm not going to talk about ways to not do modern branding. I think there's a lot of very valid ways or brands that aren't doing a good job because that's not constructive. I just think that over the last several years at Spotify, we've built our brand in perhaps a bit of an unorthodox way, and that there are some principles within that that can be applied across a lot of different brands of a lot of different sizes, whether you're on the brand marketing side or on the agency side. Our team at Spotify, based out of New York, we have about 85 folks, and we function sort of halfway as in-house agency and halfway as brand marketers. So I've tried to sort of meet the middle of that Venn diagram here to pull some things out. And the first question, just to get on the same page, because I think a lot of these things can turn into jargon if we're not careful, what is a modern brand, or at least how do we define what a modern brand is? I think it's a few things. The first is a brand that's built with purpose. For those who were here this morning, Alon Sylvan from Sylvan Labs gave a great presentation on brand purpose, and it can mean a lot of different things, as we heard. In our case, it's about staying very true to the thing that we make, the product that you hold in your hand, and making sure that we're sort of respectful and understanding of that and emotional relationship that people have with music. Secondly, a modern brand stands for more than a product. And in that case, it's a matter of having a purpose that built inside of just the app that you hold in your hand and understanding that people are going to have a bit of a, like I said, an emotional relationship with that. And thirdly, it knows who it's designed for. It's not going to be for everybody, and it doesn't have to be for everybody. So that's what I think are sort of the basic three principles of building a modern brand. So it means considering your brand in a post-digital world, and that's a dangerous statement too, because that can also turn into jargon very quickly. But it's something that we talk about a lot, and there are a couple of sort of key principles inside of that that we can follow too. Post-digital means acknowledging new roles for technology in our lives. It means understanding that for us, we still think in terms of channels, we still think in terms of briefs around particular social platforms, whatever it might be. But consumers have moved far beyond that, and the break between their online and offline lives is non-existent. And the existence of technology in their lives as an enabling force is not something that they think of sort of as an on switch and an off switch. It's something that exists across everything. Secondly, it means favoring purpose over novelty. Being in a post-digital world as a brand, I think, means that we are far beyond the days of microsites that were built for the sake of themselves, building digital tools that aren't really tools at all. They really serve the brand more than the person, and just making sure that everything we create stands up to that litmus test of being something that's purposeful and meaningful for the audience. And the third piece is focusing on humanity. As I mentioned before, as people are becoming more sort of obviously reliant on their devices and the technology around them, it means that the line between what's technology and what isn't is rapidly blurring for them, so it needs to for us as well. And understanding that we need to go into sort of being more human as brands ourselves is the operative piece. And one thing we like to say is that if our audience has become half machine, it's up to us to become half human as well and to try and meet them halfway. If they're becoming more accepting of the types of technology that we're bringing into their lives, especially as a music platform, it's incumbent on us to understand that that humanity is going to be baked into it as well. So for us, this meant a couple of things. One of them is building a brand, building a brand that is vibrant and personable, making sure that we represent all the various parts of music culture, certainly, and also the different ways and reasons that people come to Spotify. Secondly, it meant defining our purpose as a brand and understanding what we stand for beyond just an app you hold in your hand. And thirdly, it meant making sure that we always have a point of view in everything that we do, that everything has a sharp point, and we aren't doing anything just for the sake of itself, like I mentioned. So I want to go back a little bit to where we started, just briefly. Who here uses Spotify, just out of curiosity? Oh, geez, you're pandering. No way. We're in Europe. I forget. Who's had Spotify for over 10 years, since like maybe 2008, 2009? Okay, smaller group. Well, this is what the brand looked like at that point. And this made sense back in the day. This was very much similar to a lot of the other tech brands at the time, a lot of other music brands at the time, a lot of green, a lot of black, a lot of photography that was sort of jumping out at you. For those who may have seen some of the other work that we did, we had this concept called the green room on the right side. If you put it in the green room, then it's on brand. Worked for everything. It was great. And this is sort of the approach to photography, again, sort of pulling it all together. So in about 2015, we decided it's time to modernize this a little bit. This, as sort of the world has moved on from a design standpoint, obviously we're trying to be as provocative as we can be. We're about to launch in the United States, and we want to come off as modern of a brand as humanly possible. So let's go back and let's start with the visual identity. Let's try to make this a little bit more vibrant, and maybe even a little bit more flexible. And the first thing that they addressed was the green, which didn't really show up right in print or in digital, as it turned out, and looked a little bit dated. So they thought, well, let's just brighten it up. How hard could that be? We worked with a design firm called Collins in New York to help us start to rebuild the color palette. And so one day in 2015, they flipped a switch, and the logo changed from one color to the other in the App Store, on everybody's home screens, on their phones, certainly in the app when you opened it up, and we thought, fantastic, bringing the brand into the future. And the world thought slightly differently about that modernization that we had done. This wasn't the only tweet, nor the only, there were several think pieces as well on the matter. People were freaked out. They didn't like that we'd changed the green. And we thought, what the heck, it's color green, easy guys, like this isn't that hard. But it was also, it's a little bit funny, of course, and it's the internet. Over one day, this subsided and something else took hold. But it was a moment of levity for us as well, because we realized, whether we had done it intentionally or not, we had built a brand that people had a relationship with. And changing the color green on their home screen had an effect on that relationship. And that we had to respect the fact that it wasn't up to us how they felt about the brand, it was up to them. We had an obligation to respect that relationship between us and the fans, and that's something that we've considered ever since. We're not the type of brand that wants to come out and do something new just for the sake of it. We're not a brand that wants to test your relationship with us just for the sake of it either. And that was a good example of a time when we learned a lot about the relationship we really had with our users. We don't get to dictate brand perception. They do it for us. That's something we should probably have painted up on the wall that I think many brands should. So we built a visual brand. That was the first piece of this. And it's worth talking about because it lays some of the foundation for a lot of the work that we've done since. We've given ourselves a bit of flexibility from that perspective. We looked at the vibrance of music and music culture. We looked at the way that music has been promoted over the years. A lot of bold colors, a lot of singular and dual tones. And then we looked back at the work that we were doing at the time. Pretty big difference. So we built out a new color palette for ourselves, we built out a new sense of identity, and we allowed that level of flexibility to be able to be represented in all sorts of different ways, in all sorts of different contexts, alongside all sorts of different content, and certainly in a whole lot of different products too. This is part of the way that our system operates, and for example, something like Spotify Singles, for those who know, we put out a couple of these every week. They're sort of our in-studio recordings. They're all quite different. They're all something that resonates with the artists that we're representing, but they're all also very Spotify. So that was a big piece of this. It also allows us to get into building cultural brands that work for a very particular audience. With the hip-hop audience, this is our largest hip-hop playlist, Rap Caviar, with about 13 million people listening to it every week, I think, something like that. We built this inside of our design system, or capturing the vibrance of Latin music in Viva Latino, which is our flagship Latin music playlist. Again, it's inside that visual system as well. So it's very flexible, but it allows us to do a lot of different things and sort of meet people halfway, as we said. It also led us into our brand strategy and where we wanted to focus the sentiment of the brand, and wrapping it up in a statement like this, that we are always going to stand for exploration over isolation. That's the beauty of a platform like Spotify. We help people find new music. We help people find new audio experiences. We pull them outside of their comfort zones. We will always filter out things that are relevant to them, but we're not afraid to leave some things in that are just unknown. And that's what makes us, that's what makes Spotify Spotify. That's what makes us unique. So through that positioning, through that identity, through all of that work, we've learned a few things along the way. As we've built big campaigns and small campaigns and a lot of things in between. So I'll share a few of those today. One of those, which definitely sits at the top of every creative brief that we have, is that it's a crime to be boring, and talking about yourself can be very boring. Nobody wants to talk to the person at the party who's only talking about themselves. And thankfully, we don't have to talk about ourselves very often because we have 200 million users and millions of artists on the platform who are all listening and making music and interacting every day. And we can look to that to inspire us for how to talk about that relationship more than we talk about the brand itself. So we looked for inspiration in a couple of places. How do we actually bring this type of thing into action? And we looked at things like Spotify for Artists. This is a dashboard that every Spotify artist gets access to, and it shows them where people are listening to their music, how they're listening to their music, what types of playlists they're showing up on. In this particular example, it'll show you all the playlists that a particular track is showing up on for one artist. It's really granular, but it's also really sort of humanizing in a way. We're not looking at a chart here, we're looking at the titles of playlists that people are putting, or that their songs are appearing on. It's a lot of qualitative data that that artist can use in a lot of different ways. And they use it in a lot of different ways. One of them is the band Metallica. I think this has been mentioned in the press before, but they use Spotify data to inform their playlists that they develop city by city and country by country, because the tracks that are really big in Buenos Aires are quite different to those that are going to be big in Denver or in Amsterdam. And that's not something that they tell the fans. It would be kind of weird if they got up on stage and were like, we use Spotify data to inform this playlist, our set list tonight. It's not very rock and roll, but it just makes for a better experience for the individual. They don't know that happened in the background, but they hear all their favorite songs. So I thought that's kind of cool. Or this. As we start to get into some of the qualitative pieces of how people represent music, this is a look at which artists appear in playlists that have an emoji in their title, and how commonly those artists show up in playlists that have that particular emoji across the entirety of Spotify. And it kind of tracks, right? I mean, Justin Bieber is kind of a heartfelt emoji scene there. I think Adele's some combination of heartbreak and sleep. It tracks. So you can start to see, as you look at scale and as you look at how people feel about this, we don't really have a common language of music across cultures, across languages. Emoji's probably the closest thing that we have. And these trends start to emerge. So from a brand perspective then, we thought, how do we start to take advantage of this? Where is there a place where we can try to find some of that humanity in the data and start to tell some stories about the people who use Spotify in a way that enriches everybody in the process? So one thing, as a part of a larger campaign, one of the first ones that we looked at was, let's look at the five boroughs of Brooklyn and let's try to pull out some patterns and see if maybe there's some unexpected pattern inside of that in the way that people are listening, or something that's a sort of an interesting and humanizing story across the boroughs. And one of our analysts came back and was like, you won't believe it, but Justin Bieber's latest hit, Sorry, is trending highest in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, which, for those who are not familiar with New York City geopolitics, is the most hipster, most pretentious corner of the city that wouldn't be caught dead putting on Justin Bieber at a party. But it turns out they're listening to it more than anybody. So we thought, well, we should probably tell them that. So we put up a giant billboard right in the middle of the neighborhood. Sorry, Bieber's hit trended highest in this zip code. True. Which hopefully was a redeeming point for some of those. I live in the neighborhood too, so I feel like I can make fun of it a bit. It wasn't just them. It turns out it was everybody. That's how it works. So that was the type of approach that started to inform how we take this really big pile of sort of anonymized and totally aggregated data and start to pull out things that feel very human. We've used this song a couple of times in a couple of executions. This one's from a holiday campaign the next year. Dear person who played Sorry 42 times on Valentine's Day, what did you do? It's a moment in time. Or just from last year, we can start to pull out how people actually title their playlists and just make some larger points. This isn't a statement that the brand is making. It's a reflection of culture. Music is a mirror on culture, we believe. And it's sort of data points like this that turn into the best proof points of that. It can be very earnest. It can be serious if we want it to. Number of playlists called Get Out of My Country versus Welcome to America. Again, we're not saying it. That's just a reflection of the data. But it can also be very funny. Top yodeling playlists. These are real, by the way. It wouldn't be real if we didn't just sort of actually dig into the platform. We're not making this stuff up. And I have listened to Deep Scottish Yodel Trap. Don't recommend it. It's a global approach, and it's something that's very easy for us to scale. And it's an easy thing for us to go work with an agency in another country and bring them up to speed on how we do this. It's an easy way for us to let the brand shine, even when we're really just talking about how people interact with the music around them. And so this is sort of the approach that that we've taken. So that's sort of the first point there. Talking about ourselves can be boring, and thankfully, we rarely have to. The second point, I'll tell a quick story before I sort of reveal it. Most importantly, it's a slightly different shade of purple. Great transition. In 2016, we got a really interesting call that for the first time since streaming music became a thing, that Prince's catalog was going to come onto streaming services, including Spotify. And we thought, this is a huge moment. We should probably say something, especially to Prince's fans. It was about 2 weeks before the Grammys, and media was basically bought out. There wasn't really anything for us to tack into. But our media team said, hey, we do have a hold on the entire Union Square subway station in New York City, which about 100,000 people go through it every day. It's one of our most trafficked stations. It's about 140 different ad placements in there. So we thought, okay, this could get interesting. We've got 2 weeks. One of them is before the release, and one of them is afterwards. Why don't we paint it purple? So we put up about 140 different ads. Oh, try this again. I think we're frozen. There we go. Throughout the station, just the logo. freaked people out. Twitter started talking. Always a good sign, talking in the right direction. Well, not completely, I guess. This is one of my favorite tweets we've ever had about us. Reach new level. True. We were like, wait for it, wait for it. And of course, about 4 a.m. the day that the platform actually, that all of his music came to the platform, we went in and repainted everything with Prince's face across it. The whole station. And it was a moment for us where we wanted to speak specifically to Prince's fans. Now, that's not a small cohort, mind you. I think everybody, to some degree, whether we know it or not, to reference one of the other presentations, is a Prince fan. But it sort of leaned back to this principle that we apply all the time, that if you try to make something for everybody, it's not really going to appeal to anyone. If we had made a major mass marketing campaign around Prince's music coming back to the platform, it would have felt like it wasn't made for the fans that were actually looking for it. And in this case, we trusted them to get it, and a lot of them did. I don't have any of the tweets in there, but there were people who had definitely figured out what was happening as soon as those ads, the blank ads, started to hit the subway station. We probably got more word of mouth out of that than we would have if we had done a big Grammy spot. So thankfully, they were sold out, and we didn't even have the chance. But if you try to make something for everyone, it's not going to appeal to everyone. And yes, of course that's hard. It means we have to build a lot of things for a lot of people, and I don't know that there's actually a shortcut to that. It doesn't mean that mass marketing doesn't work, but that level of specificity is something that requires an attuned observation on a particular audience and something that's made particularly for them. And there's always going to be someone in a meeting who raises their hand and says, but people who aren't big Prince fans aren't going to get it. And we said, exactly. Number three, no days off. We have to remind the people who are on Spotify every single day why they chose Spotify. And this isn't an acquisition play, this is about loyalty. But as a brand department, that's probably our biggest obligation, is to make sure that people feel really, really good about their decision to choose our service. So we do a lot of things to make sure that that's something that they see. This is the way that you get onboarded to Spotify, for everyone it seems who has done this in the past, it's probably been a while, but when you load up the app for the first time, it has you click across a number of artists to figure out which ones you like. And as you click on one, the rest of them reshuffle. So it starts to figure out this person likes country or this person likes R&B or some combination of the two. And you go through this process for a while, and when you get into the actual platform, it feels like it's already built for you to some degree. You have enough, there's enough context in there for us to put in the right playlists so the first experience that you have with the product is one that feels like there's been some sort of a conversation between us and the individual, and that's a very important first touch for us to make. It doesn't sound like marketing, but it absolutely is. It's things like Discover Weekly, which people have come to look forward to. That's the type of input that we need in order to get this type of output. Or it's new playlists. These just came out last week, On Repeat and Repeat Rewind, the things you're listening to a lot right now. The things you're listening to a lot right now and the things you listened to a lot a long time ago. We've built this relationship with listeners that they trust us to bring them something new like this because we talk to them like they're a member of the club. Some things last forever, some things don't. There are playlists we've put out that definitely have been sunsetted relatively quickly because it turns out they just didn't hit what we wanted them to hit. But users have given us a lot of permission to do that because we trust them to be a part of this universe as well. They're almost excited to find out what we're going to make for them next, which makes us very fortunate from a marketing and loyalty standpoint, certainly. But it's something that we have to treat very carefully and not exploit at all. And we certainly try not to. Back to the point about Metallica. We do a lot of live shows. This is one that we did in New York about 3 years ago. We also figure out which artists that we want to approach to be a part of these shows based on who's listening and what zip codes. That doesn't sound like rocket science. It's not. But it does make for a much better experience for everybody who has a chance to attend. It means that we're always thinking about exactly what the individual localized interests are in that area. And just like Metallica, we don't tell people that we did that, it's just a matter of fact. We do a lot of fans first events is what we call them as well. I think we're up to about 2,000-ish or something like that, where we hit up maybe the top 200 or 500 fans of a certain artist in a certain zip code and put on a show with that artist and invite them along. This is one we did with Interpol in Mexico City. Is that scalable? Well, it is to a certain degree, but obviously we can't hit 200 million people with that message. But what it does for a small group, and certainly does for the perception of our brand, is give this idea that we're thinking about how we extend it off platform and also how we sort of reward people for being a part of Spotify. You know, it's an environment that feels very one-to-one because it is. So that's at like a very personal level. At scale, it's a bit different. This is an older one, but I brought it back for this presentation because I thought it was just relevant based on sort of everything that folks are talking about today. It was called Found Them First, and it was from maybe 5 years ago. And you plugged in your Spotify credentials, and it told you which famous artists you listened to before anyone else did, which is like the biggest ego feed for any individual, of course. You click through, and it's like, oh, you discovered 8 people before anyone else. Maybe, you know, you're in the first 1% of all people who ever listened to Mark Ronson. That's pretty cool. And everyone tweets about it. It's sort of demonstrates the back and forth. Again, it doesn't sound like marketing. It doesn't feel like marketing, but that's exactly the point. It gets people into that space. And the one that you may be familiar with most is our end of year wrap up, in which we give every single user on Spotify a story about what they listened to over the course of the year. The first things they listened to, the playlists that were the most popular, the artists that sort of took up most of their time, their first podcast they discovered, all those things. And it's a very interesting sort of moment for us as a brand as well, because we get a chance to just give something back. This is a pure loyalty play as well. We don't acquire new users off the back of this. It's only for people who have Spotify and have had it for a little while. But it's felt like it always helps us just maintain that relationship and also keeps people active and it keeps people coming back. It keeps people listening more. It's kind of the whole point. The first thing people listen to during the year is always a funny one too, because it's usually a song right after midnight, so people definitely don't remember what it was. And they share. Millions of people share. Millions of people put out a small ad on our behalf, and it's about them. It's not about us. These are a lot of very heavy listeners, I'm realizing. 90,000 minutes a year, wow. But it's true, and even if it's not quantitative, you know, no matter what you listen to during the year, no matter how you did it, it's going to give you a story that's worth sharing. That's the idea. Artists do it as well. So that brings me to the fourth point and final point. One that, as a data-focused company, and I'm sure that for most of you in the room, you're using data to inform the marketing decisions that you make, I would hope. You're also probably looking at some proprietary data as a company versus that which you can lease from other places. Should you talk to your existing customers, or should you talk to those who are not a part of your customer base at all yet? This has become increasingly important for us, and I think for most, that the next fan that you reach is not going to look like the last fan that you reach. And the next million people who sign up for Spotify aren't going to listen like the last 10 million, or be persuaded by the same messages as the last 10 million, or have the same relationship with us as the last 10 million people do. I think it's partially the nature of being a technology company, but more importantly, I think it's just a matter of understanding that as you move through new markets and new audiences, and as culture shifts, you're going to have to revise the way that you approach those. It can be very reductive to look at your own data set. You can find yourself in a recursive loop of only appealing to those who have already decided to be your customer, while missing some huge points on the outside of that as well. So with that, I'll leave you with one of the last pieces of film that we made, not data at all. We've done a lot of numbers up there, hopefully interesting ones. But this is a representation of that. It's an ad that we wouldn't have made 5 years ago. It's probably not an ad we would have made 1 year ago. It represents a new way of us trying to push the brand forward to a new audience. Some of you may have seen it, maybe not, but I'll let it play.
Okay.
But I can survive my life. I'm still fighting for peace. Oh, I've got thick skin and an elastic arm.
Thanks. That was done by our in-house team. If you were here for the first presentation today, you can probably reverse engineer the brief based on what you saw there. Thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it. I hope it was interesting. I hope there are some things in there that you can go back and apply. And yeah, that's my Twitter handle. Reach out if you want to talk. Thanks.